Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, June 14th, 2020. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. Today's weather in Cedar Rapids will include sunny skies and a high around 76 degrees. Tonight will be partly cloudy, with a low around 58. We'll enjoy 15 hours and 13 minutes of daylight today, with sunset tonight at 8:44 p.m., and sunrise tomorrow at 5:31 a.m. Today's top story in the Gazette is written by Grace King and Marissa Payne, titled, Created Equal, But Not All Treated Equal. Thousands of protesters laid face down with their hands behind their backs on First Avenue E for the second Saturday in a row, this time calling out Mama at the 7-minute and 30-second mark, just like George Floyd did before he died. The protest was organized by a grassroots group called Advocates for Social Justice, which is making 7 demands for police reform, including enacting a citizens' review board of the police and stricter rules on officer body cameras. Cedar Rapids Police Chief Wayne German said Friday the city would create a citizens' board, but the details of its makeup and powers were not determined. Saturday's protest was one of hundreds across the United States that sprang up after Floyd, a black man, was killed on Memorial Day in Minneapolis when a police officer knelt on his neck for nearly 9 minutes, cutting off his airway. The protesters Saturday called for Cedar Rapids police officer Lucas Jones to be fired. Jones, a white officer, shot Jareem Mitchell, a black man, in 2016 during a traffic stop, paralyzing him. A police video showed Mitchell driving away from the traffic stop with Jones caught in the door of the moving pickup truck. A grand jury declined to indict Jones, but the family later filed suit. That case has yet to go to trial, and German declined last week in an interview with the Gazette to discuss Jones while the lawsuit was pending. Louise Mitchell, Jareem Mitchell's mother, said in an interview Saturday she wants to see justice for all because, quote, it doesn't matter who you are, what color you are, nobody deserves to be mistreated, end quote. Quote, I'm just here to make sure justice prevails, Mitchell said, and a lot of things go on in this world that are overlooked, and it shouldn't be, because we are all created equal, but we're not all treated equal. And that's why I'm here again. I'll be here the next time, fighting for justice, end quote. She spoke June 6th to a crowd in Green Square to call for justice. She did not speak to Saturday's gathering, but said she wanted to see the city act on the protesters' demands for police reform. Quote, we need a lot of change in this town, Mitchell said. We need a lot of change in this world. It's too much hate and not enough love. And we need to see the city council, the mayor, and all the chiefs and everybody who sits up in these high positions, we need to see them do their jobs, not uphold people when they do wrong, end quote. Saturday's protest began at Beaver Park, where the crowd heard from several speakers, including one of the protest organizers, Antonio Chalmers. Cedar Rapids City Council member Dale Todd and State Representative Liz Bennett, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids. As people began showing up, they were given the opportunity to register to vote. The reason President Donald Trump is in the White House is because, quote, we didn't vote, Todd said. I'm here today because these are serious times. George Floyd will be this generation's defining moment, end quote. Chalmers said when he was asked to take the stage and speak, his initial reaction was no. Quote, I'm not in a good mental place with everything going on, he said. I looked at the crowd, and I see all these people out here that are joining for a cause that's much bigger than myself. Chalmers read a poem he wrote, calling for police reform and for officers to live in the neighborhoods they police. Quote, police these neighborhoods with people from these neighborhoods instead of you sending in the ones afraid of us that hated us. The same cop these kids of dreaming, when they grow up, killed a father within minutes of showing up, he recited. After the speakers concluded, protesters marched on Beaver Avenue Southeast, stopping on the corner of 19th Street Southeast to chalk Black Lives Matter. Protesters filled in an outline with different colors of chalk and wrote sayings such as, quote, the system isn't broken, it was built this way, end quote. Tyre Walker, age 26, who led the demonstration on First Avenue, said he wanted protesters to try to feel what Floyd felt. He said he is worried for his life and for his four children, who are ages 7, 6, 4, and 2. Quote, without change of systemic oppression, I feel I or my kids or someone else in my family will fall, Walker said between leading chants. Walker asked protesters to look to their left and to their right. Quote, that's your neighbor, he said. If you see them get pulled over by the police, you stop, end quote. After sitting on First Avenue at the corner of 15th Street East for about 15 minutes, protesters marched four blocks to 19th Street before heading back to Beaver Park. Marshawn Williams, age 30, marched with his three children, ages 10, 9, and 5. Williams was hesitant to bring them to the protest for fear it would turn unruly, but after witnessing a peaceful protest in Cedar Rapids the week before, he wanted them to be a part of it. Quote, I don't want them to miss out on something that revolves around them and their future, end quote. Williams was glad to see people of all colors protesting alongside each other, but he isn't sure everyone fully understands the Black Lives Matter movement. Black Lives Matter isn't about black versus white or black versus the police, he said. Quote, it's about undoing an American culture that has existed for decades, centuries even, Williams said. The message is, we want to get rid of the police. The message isn't, we want to get rid of the police. We want better police that works for all, end quote. In another front page story, James Q. Lynch and Rod Boshart of the Gazette report, in waning hours of session, Iowa Republicans propose 24-hour abortion waiting period. As often is the case, the end of the 2020 Iowa legislative session came down to a budget, taxes, and abortion. Throw in an elections bill that minority Democrats called voter suppression, along with a late-night retirement speech, and what was to have been the final day of the 2020 session will be continued Sunday. In an effort to keep making progress toward adjournment, shortly after 10 p.m. Saturday, the House suspended its prohibition on voting after midnight and began debating a proposal to create a 24-hour waiting period for women seeking an abortion. Although they approved the waiting period, shortly after midnight, representatives suspended their prohibition on meeting on Sunday and agreed to come back at 10 a.m. Undeterred by the clock, the Senate continued to plug away, putting the final touches on a nearly $7.8 billion fiscal 2021 budget, $26.6 million more dollars than the current budget, but status quo for many areas of state government. Senators also approved protections for business and health care providers and shielded Iowans' federal stimulus checks and business breaks that Iowans received to help weather effects of the pandemic from state taxation. It wasn't the so-called grand tax reform that Republicans had hoped for, quote, but COVID-19 hit and changed a lot in that conversation, Senate Ways and Means Chairman Jake Chapman, a Republican from Adel, said. Before adjourning for the night, anti-abortion legislators pushed through an amendment to House File 594 after they come up three votes shy of mustering the votes to keep their so-called Protect Life Amendment on track for a voter referendum as early as 2022 to clarify abortion rights in Iowa. The waiting period wasn't the prize anti-abortion legislators wanted, but it would be a step in the right direction, said House Human Resource Committee Chairwoman Shannon Lundgren, a Republican from Piasta. Quote, we always look for pathways that we can advance the pro-life movement, she said. So when Senate amended House File 594 and sent it back to the House, quote, it was a good time to say, hey, let's move this forward and go from there, Lundgren said. The House amendment would require a physician to get written certification from the women at least 24 hours before performing an abortion. That's in line with the 1992 Planned Parenthood v. Casey decision by the United States Supreme Court that a 24-hour waiting period was not an undue burden, she said. Now, 27 states have waiting periods. Quote, Iowa already recognizes waiting periods in the code for a reasonable amount of time to consider a life-impacting decision, she said, citing the state's waiting periods of 72 hours for a marriage license, 72 hours after a birth for an adoption, and 90 days for a divorce. However, Representative Beth Wessel Crochel, a Democrat from Ames, found it ironic that at the same time Republican-led state government considers it Iowans' personal responsibility to wash their hands and wear face masks to prevent the spread of COVID-19, the legislature wants to insert itself into decisions about women's reproductive health. Quote, the fact is that Republicans trust Iowans to do the right thing, except when it is a pregnant woman, Wessel Crochel said. Democrats were, quote, appalled, end quote, Saturday afternoon when just hours before they expected to adjourn the session, quote, Republican politicians planned to pass more restrictions on a woman's right to make her own health decisions, said Representative Joe Olson, a Democrat from Des Moines. Quote, they've kept this plan secret for weeks and released it on a Saturday night so they didn't have to hear from Iowans, Olson said. Quote, it's time for Iowa Republican lawmakers to be more transparent and stop the relentless attacks on the rights of Iowa's women, end quote. The measure passed 53-42 with one Democrat, Representative Andy McKean of Anamosa, voting with Republicans. After a much lengthier debate, about 5:40 a.m., the Senate voted 31-16 to send the bill to the governor. One fight that didn't materialize was the restoration of felon voting rights. Lawmakers declined to take up a resolution that would have let voters decide whether to amend the state constitution to allow felons to vote once they just discharge their sentences. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Brad Zahn, a Republican from Urbandale, deferred to Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, a Republican from Ankeny, on the issue. However, he said his thoughts were with crime victims. Quote, it's a very emotional issue, and secondly, all indications are the governor is going to sign an executive order, Zahn said. That has been the speculation ever since the Republican governor met with Black Lives Matter earlier in the week. Previously, Reynolds has resisted that, saying instead that restoration should be addressed in the Constitution, not left to the whim of the governor. Representative Russ Smith, a Democrat from Waterloo, agreed that a permanent solution like a constitutional amendment would be best. Quote, if it's a bargaining chip every year that we can count on them pulling back from the table when it comes time to ante up, that's disappointing, Smith says. The historic passage of police reforms earlier in the week and retreats from pushing voter referendums on restoring voting rights and restricting abortion were a marked shift from the agenda lawmakers wrote for the session. Although not in lockstep, Reynolds and legislators were focused on a number of shared priorities that included more funds for education, so-called upskilling the workforce, expanding mental health services, and providing more funds for outdoor recreation and water quality improvement. As the evening wore on, the Senate voted 44-4 to strengthen the state's animal cruelty laws. Zahn lamented that the House had so-called weakened provisions in H.F. 737 that senators had previously passed. However, the revised bill would still protect companion animals and, quote, prosecute the people that are abusing companion animals, end quote. Quote, countless times, almost on a daily basis, we hear stories in the media of just disgusting abuse of our companion animals that so many times are members of our families, said Zahn, in urging passage of the measure establishing an aggravated misdemeanor for animal torture and providing enhanced current penalties for animal abuse and neglect. Senator Tony Bisignano, a Democrat from Des Moines, said it was, quote, a long road, end quote, to get to Saturday night's vote, saying, quote, we've done everything, about everything that we could, end quote, in negotiating a bill that, quote, takes Iowa out of the gutter of, I think, 49th in the country, end quote, in national rankings. Quote, it's not everything I would want if I wrote it, but it's everything we need to move forward, end quote. In coronavirus news, Sarah Watson of the Gazette reports 8 more Iowans died of COVID-19 since Friday morning, the state reported at 11 a.m. Saturday, bringing the total to 650 deaths in Iowa due to the respiratory illness. No deaths were reported in Linn or Johnson counties. The state also recorded an additional 398 positive cases, bringing the state's total to 23,555, with about 60% of those recovered. More than 6,000 Iowans were tested from 11 a.m. Friday to 11 a.m. Saturday, with a positive case rate of about 6%. Polk County, the county with the most COVID-19 cases, surpassed 5,000 positive cases on Friday. That county's population is a little more than twice Linn's, but has reported 5 times the number of positive cases. Hospitalizations statewide have continued to decline for the 17th consecutive day, according to the Department of Public Health. 200 Iowans are hospitalized due to the novel coronavirus, the lowest total since April 17th. The number of patients in intensive care units, 73, and on ventilators, 43, are also down. Another positive COVID-19 case was added to the Willow Gardens Care Center's total in Marion, a Linn County long-term care center that reported an outbreak among residents and staff on Thursday. There are now 12 cases at the center. In western Iowa, Buena Vista County's Good Samaritan Society was added to the list of outbreaks. Jasper County's Acura Healthcare, roughly 100 miles west of Cedar Rapids, was removed. The Cedar Rapids Test Iowa site will open at a different location on Monday. Previously at Kirkwood Community College, the relocated site will be at the Department of Transportation Office, District 6 office at 5455 Kirkwood Boulevard. Michaela Ram of the Gazette reports on why is the Cedar Rapids Family Medicine Residency Program closing. On July 1st, the Cedar Rapids Family Medicine Residency Program, the sole training program for family medicine doctors following their graduation from medical school, will close its doors. Earlier this year, Mercy Medical Center and Unity Point Health St. Luke's jointly announced officials no longer would support the Cedar Rapids Medical Education Foundation, which was established in 1971 to oversee the three-year residency program. The foundation had been set up to address a family medicine physician shortage in Cedar Rapids, with the hopes that residents would continue practicing in the community after graduation. However, in the past 5 years, 31% of residents remained in Cedar Rapids after graduation, according to officials. In addition, funding from federal officials for graduate medical education no longer was meeting up with the actual cost to run the program, said Mercy Medical Center CEO Tim Charles. When cost of recruiting became significantly less than standing up a program that wasn't retaining residents in the community, he said officials had to reconcile the cost-benefit. Quote, the deficit was getting greater and greater, and it became fairly clear that sustainability was not feasible, Charles said. In a related story, Michaela Ram reports, free clinics brace for pandemic side effects. As the effects of the novel coronavirus pandemic continue to ripple across the nation, its effect on the uninsured rates among the Cedar Rapids population remains unknown, but is worrisome to local healthcare officials. For those who have lost jobs that offered benefits, it probably means they've lost their health insurance, too. That, coupled with the loss of a long-time training program for up-and-coming family physicians, could have a compounding effect on patient numbers for local free medical clinics and Cedar Rapids' federally qualified health center. All are working in tandem to care for lower-income and at-risk populations. Quote, national and local data indicates more people are deferring care and we are concerned, officials from both Cedar Rapids hospitals said in a joint statement. Quote, we want people to seek care when they need it for emergencies and other preventive measures. Quote, we also believe sites of care like the Eastern Iowa Health Center and Free Medical Clinic may experience higher volumes as people begin to seek care again, end quote. This past week, 1.9 million Americans filed for unemployment, bringing the pandemic-related job loss total to more than 42 million. In the first week of June, Iowa Workforce Development received more than 10,000 unemployment claims, bringing the total number of claims in Iowa to nearly 160,000. Quote, the Eastern Iowa Health Center, along with other healthcare and community leaders, fear that more people will lose insurance as a result of the pandemic, said Eric Langdon, Chief Development Officer for the federally qualified health center based in Cedar Rapids. As a result, area free medical clinics, which provide health care for those facing economic barriers, are preparing for an influx of patients down the road. Quote, physicians are usually willing to refill medications and things like that for the short term, especially in this situation with the pandemic going on. But I suspect in 2 or 3 months down the road, we will see more patients, said Dr. Cecilia Norris, medical director of the Iowa City Free Medical Clinic. In most cases, patients at the community health free clinic in Cedar Rapids would qualify for Medicaid. Providers at free clinics would see those patients only once they are enrolled in the program, and then they would be sent to the Eastern Iowa Health Center for the long term, said Jamie Henley, chief operating officer at Community Health Free Clinic. As a federally qualified health center, the Eastern Iowa Health Center receives a higher reimbursement rate from federal officials to provide primary care to underserved populations, including low-income earners who might have lost their jobs. However, Another factor in play within the Cedar Rapids medical community could leave the free clinics with a larger patient population in the longer term, Henley said. As July approaches, so does the official closure date of a long-term training program for up-and-coming family physicians. The Cedar Rapids Family Medicine Residency Program, the sole family medicine residency program in Cedar Rapids, will be discontinued effective July 1st after almost 50 years. Of the 21 current residents, 7 will graduate this summer, and the remaining 14 already have found placement in programs elsewhere, officials said. The residents' medical home was at the Eastern Iowa Health Center, where they provided care for about 7,000 people. That's equivalent to 3 full-time doctors, said Dr. James Bell, medical director of his Hands Free Clinic in Cedar Rapids. Quote, the question is, can they, without residents, absorb 7,000 patients? Don Brower said, his Hands executive director. His Hands Free Clinic is moving to a new clinic at 412th Street Southeast this month, which is expected to open to the public July 7th. The bigger space will allow the clinic to take on more patients day-to-day, Brower said. However, given the financial hit they have taken in the midst of the pandemic, Bell said concern remains about how the free clinics could absorb an increased patient volume. Quote, at his Hands, what can we do to help fill that gap? We don't know how we're going to answer that, he said. But hospital officials are confident that they can meet the need. In addition to the hospital's recruiting programs, the Eastern Iowa Health Center, established in 2006, quote, stands ready to continue serving this population, officials said in a news release. In, quote, in fact, Eastern Iowa Health Center has been actively recruiting providers since the Cedar Rapids Medical Education Foundation announcement and is well positioned to care for existing and new patients, the statement reads. Quote, if hospital care is needed, both hospitals have hospitalists that will provide care for these patients, end quote. Langdon said the health center is part of a community-wide response to provide increased insurance enrollment assistance for public insurance options, such as Medicaid and private insurance available through the federal marketplace. Quote, additionally, no patient is turned away at Eastern Iowa Health Center due to inability to pay, she said. Quote, we provide assistance to uninsured patients on a sliding fee scale and will continue to serve patients throughout the year, despite their insurance status, end quote. Mercy Medical Center CEO Tim Charles said Cedar Rapids hospitals also continue to put an emphasis on robust recruiting. They hope to bring in advanced practitioners, such as physician assistants and nurse practitioners, to meet the need in providing primary care. From the community health free clinics perspective, bridging the gap for those patients for a longer period of time is not a concern. Quote, that's not new for us, Henley said. We did the same thing when the Affordable Care Act came out, end quote. We'll figure it out, he added. That's the thing with us. We've got a lot of great partners who work with us, a lot of great volunteers, so we'll figure out ways to help patients and whatever they need and really make sure they're taken care of. Quote, the rest of it we'll figure out as we go along, end quote. In today's Insight page, Jerry Harrington of Iowa City writes a column titled, In the 1960s, Iowa Governor Showed a Path to Racial Understanding. The death of George Floyd in Minneapolis and the subsequent protests and violence has left America's leaders with an unanswerable question. What to do? History provides examples of political leaders rising to this challenge. One such politician was Iowa Governor Harold Hughes, who faced racism in Iowa and appealed to Iowans to rise above their prejudices. On the surface, Hughes seemed an unlikely candidate for this mission. Born in rural western Iowa, he saw few, if any, African Americans growing up. A rough-hewed truck driver, Hughes overcame alcoholism and served 3 terms as governor in the mid-1960s. Elected to the U.S. Senate in 1968 for a single term, he entered Christian lay work and built clinics for other alcoholics. He died in 1996. It was his actions in 1967. Sorry, he died in 1996. It was his actions in 1967 and 1968 that we can look back on today. At this time, American cities burned with race riots. Iowa cities with African American populations, such as Des Moines and Waterloo, erupted with protests and violence. Hughes realized he knew little about the black experience in Iowa. He remedied this by visiting homes of black families in Des Moines. He was overcome by the stark poverty and despair he saw. Most importantly, he listened to their stories of racial prejudice that impacted their lives. He visited other African-American homes in Iowa, talking with large groups and taking into his soul their life stories, conversations often lasting until 2 a.m. Then he acted. He got businesses in Iowa's large cities to provide unemployment, to provide employment for black youths to quell the possible violence, creating 20,000 summer jobs. But Hughes realized the issue was greater than that. It was racism itself, raw, burning prejudice that assaulted human dignity. Hughes joined with Iowa Methodist Bishop James Thomas of Des Moines, an African American, to create the so-called crisis conferences. These were a series of assemblies organized by Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish leaders in 6 of Iowa's largest cities, Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, Davenport, Sioux City, Waterloo, and Council Bluffs, to rally Iowans against racism in early 1968. These could have turned into shallow gatherings of nice platitudes, except they were headlined with a bold address by Hughes, one of the most charismatic speakers in Iowa history. A large, handsome man with a deeply rich and booming baritone voice, Hughes spoke as if a prophet from the Old Testament. These addresses were more sermons than speeches. Of his visits to black homes, Hughes said, quote, "I was humbled and ashamed, for I had lived in an ivory tower in office for 5 years while people within 5 blocks of the Capitol lived in poverty. Yes, I felt bitterness and resentment against the so-called white power structure that had been grinding these people into the ground without even knowing it," end quote. Speaking to thousands, Hughes called upon Iowans to empathize with their African-American neighbors, urging all to place themselves in the shoes of their black brethren. He asked they try to understand the burden of bigotry. Offering no simple answers, Hughes stressed understanding, empathy, and most importantly, compassion. He later said, quote, "I felt that I was not only swimming upstream, but that I was taking a major step to destroy whatever political future I might have had. But it really didn't matter to me. I felt that a message had to be brought to the people of Iowa and America, and that for a man to shirk his responsibility in bringing that message would be the worst thing he could ever do," end quote. Did Hughes' actions make a difference? Perhaps not. Racism obviously still exists, as we well know today. But his actions provide a direction, a hope, that public officials can lead us on a better path, that they can take chances to call forth, as Lincoln said, the better angles of our nature. This was done by Hughes. Instead of holding a Bible for a photo op, Hughes lived it. This column was written by Jerry Harrington of Iowa City, who is writing a biography of Iowa Governor and Senator Harold Hughes. Today's letters to the editor include one written by Joanne McNeil from Cedar Rapids, titled, Patriotism Includes Room for Protest. Our country was founded by people who rebelled against injustices from a tyrannical, oppressive system and fought for democratic principles and human rights. Then they proceeded to tear apart foreign families, ship them here in horrific conditions, and force them into autocratic, suppressive, and brutal slavery systems. Today, people who peacefully protest some of our current unjust and often brutal systems are demonized for giving voice to their constitutionally supported rights. Parenthetical comment, do not confuse constitutionally protected peaceful protest with lawless violence and destruction. Close paren. Our Pledge of Allegiance ends with, quote, indivisible with liberty and justice for all, end quote. Liberty and justice for whom? Only certain skin colors and incomes? Our national anthem ends with, quote, the land of the free and the home of the brave, end quote. Who is free? Who are the brave ones now? Taking a knee is a metaphorical rising up to help us all take another look at what we say and how, as a nation, we are often not living up to our words. I respect our country's founding principles and our veterans who fought for them. Respect and patriotism, however, must include supporting the protests of our citizens who have not benefited from those so-called inalienable rights and indeed have been subjected to oppression and brutality. Patriotism is not either or, it's both and. Quote, red, brown, yellow, black, and white, all are precious in his sight, end quote. Remember that song from childhood? Remember the golden rule? Can we live up to the principles that will make our country respectable again? Signed, Joanne McNeil of Cedar Rapids. Bob Mehta of Des Moines writes, Grassley should support clean energy. Air pollution affects all Americans, but it disproportionately impacts low-income communities and their communities of color, especially those near high-traffic areas. There are plenty of great bills that are sitting in the Senate that help protect the environment by creating thousands of jobs in the growing demand for electric vehicles. Tailpipe pollution has been linked to a variety of public health problems, and climate change further exacerbates the impacts. Electric vehicles drastically reduce tailpipe pollution, but the manufacturing of electric vehicles is under attack from the fossil fuel industry. Senator Chuck Grassley needs to stand up to EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler and his administration's reckless rollbacks of environmental protection. There is a wide-ranging bipartisan support for tax extenders for electric vehicles, and Grassley needs to champion clean energy opportunities. Signed, Bob Mehta of Des Moines. Dr. Megan Srinivas of Fort Dodge writes, Lawmakers should remember CDC's work. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, plays a critical role in our nation's pandemic response and in our day-to-day public health. From providing guidance for medical professionals to instructing the public on public personal safety measures, our communities are better equipped to handle this coronavirus crisis because of the work done by the CDC. Additionally, the CDC's Prevention and Public Health Fund allows officials to detect, prevent, and respond to health threats, including the current pandemic. The work of the CDC should be at the forefront of our elected officials' minds when they are making budget decisions. Eliminating or even attempting to eliminate these appropriations is irresponsible for our public health. Both in this global pandemic and in the time that follows, which I know is hard to imagine, I hope you will join me in reminding our elected officials of the importance of the CDC and their role in adequately funding its work. Signed, Dr. Megan Srinivas of Fort Dodge. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, June 14, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Cedar Rapids. Ronald E. Gilson, aged 80, died Thursday, June 11th. Arrangements by Brosh Chapel and the Abbey Center of Cedar Rapids. Ronald L. Randall Sr., aged 80, of Grundy Center, died Sunday, June 7th. Celebration, Celebrate Iowa Life, West Des Moines is handling arrangements. Kathleen D. Bruce, of Cedar Rapids, age 95, passed away Wednesday, April 1st, at the Hiawatha Care Center. A public visitation will be held from 1 to 2 p.m. Saturday, June 20th at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. A private memorial mass will follow at the chapel. Private family graveside services were already held at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Please visit the complete obituary for Kathleen D. Bruce at the website www.cedarmemorial.com. Mark Whitney Liker, aged 71, passed away in his home in St. George, Utah, on Wednesday, June 10th, following a short illness. He was born in Long Island, New York, to parents Helen, Diener, and James Liker. Mark grew up in Geneva, Illinois, where he attended local public schools and the Elgin Academy. Survivors include his daughter, Amy Sanders Liker, and Tracy of Cedar Rapids, and son, Ben Liker of Tipton. Margaret Lucille Mathis, known as Peg, of Marion, aged 91, formerly of Iowa City, passed away Tuesday, February 18, 2020, at West Ridge Care Center in Cedar Rapids with her family by her side. The family will greet friends from 1:30 to 2 p.m. Saturday, June 20th, at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Social distancing will be observed. Mary Lou Ellis, aged 86, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully surrounded by her three children at West Ridge Care Center on Thursday, June 11th. A private family graveside service will take place next to the Ellis Century Farm. Tehan Funeral Home is serving the family. Austin Adeyemi Smith, aged 73, of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, June 5th at Mercy Medical Center following a short illness. A private family service will be held at Tehan Funeral Home. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. James Joseph Bedell, aged 67, of Robbins, died Sunday, May 17th at the Dennis and Donna Oldhorff Hospice House of Mercy following complications from Parkinson's disease. Family may visit with the family on Thursday, June 18th from 4 to 8 p.m. at Tehan Funeral Home. Burial will be 10:30 a.m. Friday at Mount Calvary Cemetery. Eldon Walter Frueling, aged 74, of North Buena Vista, formerly of Mount Vernon, passed away Wednesday, May 27th at Finley Hospital in Dubuque. Friends and family may visit and celebrate his life from 12:30 to 2:30 p.m. Friday, June 19th at the Cedar Memorial Chapel, State Room. Social distancing will be observed. Sandra K. Evans Zacek, aged 78, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Tuesday, June 9th at the Dennis and Donna Oldhorff Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. In agreement with her wishes, cremation has taken place and a celebration of Sandra's life will be held from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Saturday, July 11th at the Toddville American Legion Hall, Post 674, on Otter Road in Toddville. A private burial will take place at Shiloh Cemetery in Hiawatha. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Helen J. Schaefer, age 94, of Decorah, passed away Sunday evening, June 7th, at Oz Haugen Senior Services in Decorah. A private family graveside service will be held at Hillside Cemetery in Ossian. Juanita Overman, age 79, of Marion, formerly of Spirit Lake, passed away on Friday, May 1st, at the Views of Marion. In agreement with her wishes, cremation has taken place. A memorial mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, June 20th, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion. A joint celebration of life for Harold and Juanita will be planned at a later date in Spirit Lake. A joint committal service will take place at St. Margaret Cemetery in Spirit Lake, Iowa. Virgil A. Boynton, aged 100, of Marion, died April 11th at Wellbrook Senior Living in Avon, Indiana. A public visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, June 20th at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. A private family funeral service will follow. Dr. Peter Kennedy passed away on Wednesday, June 10th at his home in Monticello after a heroic 53-year battle with diabetes. His family will greet friends from 2 to 4 p.m. on Monday, June 15th at Getch Funeral Home in Monticello. Thoughts, memories, or condolences may be left for them at getchonline.com. Jerome J. Savitsky, Jr., aged 62, passed away May 28th in Cedar Rapids. He was a professor of economics and business at Cornell College in Mount Vernon from 1989 until his passing. A memorial event will be planned by Cornell College in Mount Vernon for a future date. A funeral mass will also be held at a later date. John Joseph Lane, a longtime resident of Benton City, Washington, passed away on May 14th at Brookdale Torbett, a memory care community in Richland, Washington, after more than a six-year battle with dementia. John was born October 3, 1937, in Clinton, Iowa, to John and Mildred Lane. In 1975, John received his AA degree from Kirkwood Community College in Parks and Natural Resources. He loved working for the Linn County Park System
at Matzell Bridge in Iowa, Menard Ag Buildings, and Menard Ag Buildings in Iowa. Joyce Jeanette Connor Stone, aged 82, of Dipping Springs, Texas, passed away peacefully at home and into the arms of our Father on May 22nd. Joyce was born in Iowa City to Marion W. Connor Sr. and Irene Finley Connor on March 11, 1938. Joyce graduated from Roosevelt High School in Cedar Rapids in 1956 and went on to become the first member of her family to attend college. Harrell Funeral Homes of Dripping Springs, Texas is handling arrangements for Joyce. Please share tributes, pictures, or memories at www.harrellfuneralhomes, that's H-A-R-R-E-L-L, .com. John Dunlap, aged 87, of Mesa, Arizona, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away after a short illness on June 4th at his home surrounded by his children. A gathering of family and friends will be held from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Friday, June 19th, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Jeffrey Lown, known as Jeff, aged 61, of Chino Valley, Arizona, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died on Friday, June 5th. A private graveside service will be held at a later date at North English Cemetery in North English. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion is assisting the family with arrangements.
Turning now to the sports page of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette, Mike Kloss's column is titled, Merriweather Finds He Isn't Alone on an Island. He has just one career start, but redshirt sophomore safety Kayvon Merriweather became a voice of the Iowa Hawkeyes football team recently, and in a way that would have seemed unimaginable a week or so earlier. It was extraordinary, really. From being a member of a team barred from using Twitter by its coach, Merriweather used his newfound freedom to tweet to put out a statement that basically would have been a resignation from the team in weeks and years past, because it would have been denounced and punished. Quote, if you cannot support us right now with this movement and with our team taking a knee during the national anthem, do not support us during the football season, said a statement Merriweather attached to a tweet last Monday. Quote, do not watch our games on TV. Do not come up to us when you want photos. Do not ask us to give your kids autographs. Do not come to us expecting us to do for you when you can't support the black athletes on the team and the decisions we make as a team. I would rather play in front of 1,000 fans who care about us as people outside of football and what we are standing for than 70,000 fans who only care about us when we are in uniform and are on the field entertaining them, end quote. As of Saturday morning, the tweet had over 800 comments, 3,300 retweets, and 17,500 likes. Some of the comments were predictably critical. Quote, like, quote, I will turn in my tickets, not watch on TV, and quit making contributions to the U of I if you take a knee at the national anthem. I'd rather the ungrateful athletes leave and preserve the program I've been supporting and proud of for 30-plus years, end quote. And, quote, I can promise you a kid isn't telling a grown man who has had season tickets longer than you've been alive anything. This isn't how you get folks on your side, end quote. But what Merriweather quickly learned is a lot more of those who responded were supportive, including voices that may have been inclined to chew him out not that long ago. Like, quote, I served over 20 years so Americans could be free to do things like this. I am with you and all my Hawkeyes, end quote. And, quote, you and your at Hawkeye football teammates have the full support of this Hawkeye fan, Iowan, and Army veteran. I served to protect and uphold the Constitution, which includes your right to free speech. I have never and will never be offended by someone kneeling in protest, end quote. And, quote, long-term fan and ticket holder here appreciating your words and standing in full support of the Iowa Hawkeyes making their voices, silenced for far too long, heard. Thank you. White fans, listen to our black athletes. We have so much to learn, end quote. A couple of things here before anyone gets too bent out of shape. One, it's still Kirk Ferentz's program, and he insists on unified actions by his players inside Kinnick Stadium. And if they make one about racial injustice on September 5th at their season opener, my guess it will be something less offensive to those who are more prone to being offended. Two, that game is almost 3 months away. We don't know with certainty that college football will be played that day, nor how many fans will even be in the stadium if the show goes on. The anthem thing isn't at the point of what's been going on inside the Hawkeye football's complex over the last 10 days. Instead, it's the apparent sea change within Iowa's program. Former player after former player, nearly all of them African American, made statements that reflected poorly on how Iowa coaches related to them as people. Some of the things they told us were beyond cringeworthy. Current players, by their accounts and Ferentz's at a press conference on the team's practice field Friday, said team meetings held earlier in the week were raw and emotional. Ferentz had three players speak to the media: Keith Duncan, Ivory Kelly Martin, and Merriweather. Compared to the recent history of the program, it was also an extraordinary that Eye of the Hurricane Merriweather was put out front and center instead of banned from talking publicly until further notice. But the times, they are a-changin'. The edge on Merriweather's message wasn't as sharp when he spoke Friday as opposed to his written statement of a few days earlier. His feelings, however, remained the same. Quote, "The statement was really for all of our fans, the Iowa community," Merriweather said, "to let you all know that our team, we are together as one. We expect our fans to be there for us every step of the way, and we want you all to support any decision that this team has made." Quote, "We haven't decided on kneeling or not. That's not what I said. If we do decide, any movement we do decide to support, any step that we do decide to make as a team, we want you all backing us every step of the way. Not just on the football field, but also off the field, when we're in class, when we're walking the street, when we're driving our car. We want your support day in and day out. That's really what that post meant," end quote. He said that as his head coach stood less than 10 feet away, not wincing once. Quote, "Certain things just tell you, they show you that you need to allow the players to have more freedom, more expression," Ferentz said. "Really, the issue is, do you trust them?" end quote. Ferentz called his previous Twitter ban for players, quote, "a stupid policy," end quote. He explained, quote, "its designed intent was to help protect our players. That's a parental instinct, a coach's instinct. You want to protect your players," end quote. It wasn't an evil policy, it just wasn't a good one. Iowa has long boasted about the character of its players. Letting them reveal it is the way to go. Quote, "We trust these players," Ferentz said. Maybe his players will trust their fans more than before, too. Quote, "Honestly," Merriweather said, "I expected to get a little bit of backlash, but the support from the Iowa fans was truly amazing," end quote. Quote, "amazing," end quote, is right about the way everything has unfolded for Iowa Hawkeyes football in June 2020. In other sports news, Justin Webster of the Gazette reports Hawkeye Downs kicks off second season of street drags on Sunday. Since the dawn of the automated age, speed seekers have asked, who's faster? Promoter Keith Simmons and his SPI Outlaw Street Drag event Sunday at Hawkeye Downs Speedway gives drivers the opportunity to finally decide on any ongoing debates. Quote, "It's a way to settle between you and your buddy legally whose car is fastest," Simmons said. Quote, "The event grew each month last year as we went along," end quote. Simmons is excited for the promise of the group's second season. Quote, "If we can pick up where we left off last August, it will be awesome," he said. The final event of 2019 drew 137 cars at $10 a bracket and nearly 800 fans. Quote, "We're the only ones doing this in our area," Simmons said. "It's because several of the cars are very nice and you need a paved track to do it," end quote. The next closest track with a similar event is in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Quote, "I hope to have a big gathering of car enthusiasts and it continues for a while," Simmons said. "One thing that helps draw a crowd is the ability to keep the races rolling, something organizers want to continue to improve upon." Quote, "It's 300 feet of fun, and it has wheels on it, and we have a bracket for it," said Simmons, who was hoping to attract over 100 racers. "There's a class for side-by-sides, ATVs, motorcycles, and every type of car or truck. Quote, there's something for everybody," end quote. Even if you don't want to race, $10 gains you entry to the grandstands and the chance to check out dozens of vehicles during the car show. Quote, "Not only do we have racing, we have a show and shine for the owners that don't want to run," Simmons said. They show their cars off, and then we parade them in front of the grandstands with a crowd vote by applause determining the winner, end quote. While tracks have started reopening to large numbers of people, Simmons has no doubt they have plenty of space to comply with any and all restrictions. Quote, we can be at half capacity, and we've never even been close to that, Simmons said with a laugh. The place holds 5,500, and I'd love to hit half capacity. But realistically, we will have plenty of room for everyone. This is something that everybody can do and have a little fun with, and that's what it's all about. Quote, it's something where people can come out to race without spending a lot of money, end quote. Gates open at 10:30 a.m., practice starts at 11:30, and bracket runoffs start at 12:30. In business news, John Stepp of the Gazette reports, pencils down, ACT seeks to adjust as test optional movement starts picking up steam. Many high school students were supposed to wake up early this past Saturday morning and head to Cedar Rapids Xavier High School by 8 a.m., armed with a number 2 pencil, not to be mistaken with a mechanical pencil, an eraser, a calculator, and maybe a watch. They were intended to hear carefully written instructions about the importance of filling in circles heavily and darkly and erasing entirely when changing an answer. They anticipated taking the ACT, a task completed by millions of students across the country each year, aiming to get into the college of their choice. But the novel coronavirus derailed those plans. The pandemic also has forced the Iowa City-based testing company into a difficult position, with less testing capacity and more schools dropping standardized test requirements. Quote, the coronavirus has impacted our operations with the ACT and some of our other testing programs, interim ACT CEO Janet Godwin told the Gazette. Quote, so many companies across the world, of course, have had their operations impacted, so we feel we are not alone, end quote. The precipitous drop in testing locations might be one of the more visible signs of the coronavirus's toll on the ACT. In late May, ACT announced more than 2,600 canceled test locations for June in a 57-page PDF file. That includes more than 100 cancellations in Wisconsin alone. At the locations still open, capacity was slashed by at least 50%, Godwin said. More people wanted to take the June ACT than there was space for, she said. It's unclear exactly how much revenue will be lost, but ACT charges students $52 to take the test, excluding the written portion. But that's far from the only challenge ACT faces. Since 2018, ACT's footprint in the corridor has gone from about 900 workers to 800. On May 28th, the company announced voluntary resignations, a pause in pay raises, and future cuts looming. Godwin did not provide any details on future cuts. The company also parted ways with its chief executive officer, Martin Rorta. His total compensation was more than $1 million a year, per the latest tax form 990 filed. In the past 6 years, ACT has had 3 different CEOs. More than 1,200 colleges and universities in the United States, ranging from big state schools such as the University of Nebraska to Ivy League schools such as Dartmouth University, have dropped standardized test requirements. According to Fair Test, a Cambridge, Massachusetts-based group that advocates against standardized tests, critics say the ACT tests disproportionately help students who are white and come from more affluent backgrounds. Quote, when you rely on the tests, you end up creating more barriers for access to historically disenfranchised groups, said Robert Schaefer, executive director of Fair Test. But Godwin said the ACT, not high school grades, is better at, quote, leveling the playing field, end quote. The company provides waivers for students who can't afford the test or test prep. Godwin said that benefits about 25% of students taking the test. Quote, we believe our scores are a way to help students differentiate themselves in the admissions process, Godwin said. Quote, to have an objective measure to demonstrate their level of academic achievement and readiness for college, end quote. Between 2016 and 19, ACT has seen a 14.7% drop in students taking its test. PBS reported last October that every 10 days, on average, a school was dropping its standardized test requirements. Company leadership does not need to look far from its headquarters on Highway 1 just south of Interstate 80 to see the trend. 20 miles north, Cornell College and Mount Vernon went test optional in late 2015. The largest private university in Iowa, Drake University, also does not require the ACT or SAT administered by New York-based College Board. While Iowa's three public universities, the University of Iowa, Iowa State University, and University of Northern Iowa, still require the ACT or SAT, Iowa's Board of Regents has seen mounting pressures to go test optional. The pandemic has certainly accelerated that trend. Adam Ingersoll has seen it firsthand as the co-founder of Compass Education Group, a company offering test prep across the country. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, June 14th, 2020. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.